We're counting on some good questions here.
Yes.
We want the A team to call in.
Right. No D team.
You know who you are.
Yeah.
The smart ones.
Exactly.
203-882-9757. Chaz and AJ in the morning. 99.1 PLR. In studio with us right now, Live Nation concert god Jimmy Coplick. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
You guys have a tough job. This is early.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, this is not early.
Oh,
we're
yeah,
halfway
no.
through our day right
this
now.
This is lunch right now, yeah.
Wow.
So Jimmy has this film crew following him around. What's happening with this?
They're waiting for me to break the law and put it on film
gotcha.
And get me in trouble. But in all seriousness, they're filming a documentary on my career, and this is an important part of my career, spending every Thursday morning with you guys.
Oh, that's great.
So we are going to put this into the documentary.
What an honor.
Nice. Thank you.
What an honor.
Thank you.
Now, are you sharing all kinds of stories that you shouldn't be sharing about these rock stars with them for the documentary?
It's likely.
Okay, so today's a little different. I know normally you call up and say, you know, is this band coming around or is that band coming around?
Yeah.
You could actually call in and ask Jimmy about some of the most famous concerts in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Questions about his career, things you've always wanted to know.
Right.
203-882-9757. Have you shared with them the story of Connecticut's biggest outdoor concert?
No, I have not.
Little River Band, Heart, and the Eagles at Yale Bowl.
Yes, in June of 1979, I think it was, and 70,000 people sold out in advance, and it was $15 a ticket.
Wow.
Remember those days?
Yeah. $15.
$15 a ticket, and it was a really hot day that day, a really, really hot day, and it was a very exciting day, a very, very exciting day, and Eagles being one of my favorite bands, I just love the fact that we participated in the largest concert ever in Connecticut.
70,000 people didn't know that the Eagles almost didn't go on.
That is true.
Right? No idea. No idea.
Here is the behind-the-scenes story.
Well, the Eagles are supposed to take the stage, and we couldn't find Joe Walsh. And, you know, you need your lead guitarist if you're going to get on stage. And also, Joe sings lead on a few of his solo songs yeah. that they put into the show. So we're looking all over for Joe Walsh. Finally, we go into his trailer, because every Eagle had their own trailer backstage, and Joe's fast asleep. So we try waking Joe up.
Now, are you being polite, fast asleep?
He was fast asleep.
Okay, all right.
Okay?
Well, he wasn't fast asleep.
It was nap time
the
for
method
Joe.
To get there was different.
He wasn't waking up. Let's put it that way.
Oh, my God, he's dead.
Well, we thought that at first. Right. He might be dead.
Right. They put a mirror in his nose and he's breathed
in. And we actually went over to the Little River Band, which I've never mentioned before, to see if their lead guitarist knew the Eagle songs.
Oh, wow.
Just in case Joe didn't wake up. And he was prepared. He knew all the Eagles songs. Then we went to Heart's lead guitarist. I think his name was Howard, if I remember correctly. And we asked him if he knew the Eagles songs. We thought we'd put them both on stage at the same time, because between the two of them, they should know every Eagles song.
Right.
So we end up...
So you have a contingency plan if Joe Walsh is not able to get on stage
and
perform.
Oh, it's happening, yeah.
Well, 70,000 people rioting in the Westville area of New Haven would be a really ugly scene.
That'd be ugly.
So we knew we had to get the Eagles on. So we realized that Joe had just done too much partying, to put it politely. And my head of security said, oh, we know how to wake him up. I said, how do you know? This guy was a Green Beret in Vietnam. And Rick says, oh, we had this problem in Vietnam. Get me a pail of cold ice. Okay, we get a giant pail of cold ice. We bring it to Joe's trailer, and Joe's still laying out on the trailer, in the trailer, and he says, okay, put it on the ground. I'll lift Joe up. I said, you will? He goes, yeah. He pulls Joe's pants down.
Oops.
He lifts Joe up, puts him into the ice pail. With no clothes on,
right.
No pants on. Let's put it that
way.
Yeah,
it's a Joe Walsh cup of tea.
Exactly right. iced tea.
Yes, there was no sugar in there.
Right.
We dipped him right in.
Nice.
And,
Jesus.
And all of a sudden, it was like a spark when his privates hit the ice.
Right.
It woke him right up.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes, where am I? What's going on? What's going on here? And I looked at my late, great security guy, and I go, damn, you just saved the show.
Yeah.
70,000 people. You woke Joe up.
That's it. Who knew? Putting your beans in ice would wake you right up and get you ready for a concert.
And nobody from the audience knew that 10 minutes beforehand, he was completely out cold.
Passed out.
Yeah, he was out.
And Don Henley said, I'm not going on without him.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Don Henley, Glenn Frey.
Well, Don was very insistent that Joe needed to be there. And thank God we got Joe there. And then look what happened. Then you asked Joe about it.
Right. Do we have that, Phil? That audio? Joe Walsh?
I'll take a look. Yes.
Okay. Jimmy Koplik, Live Nation. And we're filming a documentary. So if you call in a good question, you might end up on the documentary.
Yeah.
Sean and Shelton.
Hi. My question is, have you ever had any cow palace moments where, you know, like Keith Moon, where they actually made it to the stage and weren't able to perform, you know, during the concert and had to, you know, either cancel or look for somebody else in the crowd that could play?
Yeah, during Elton John's heavy cocaine use days, we had that happen in New Haven at the Coliseum, and I was pre-warned about it, and he got on stage. It was his solo show with Ray Cooper doing the drums.
Who warned you?
The tour manager actually warned me about it.
Says, hey, just a heads up, Elton's not in good shape
right now. He's on a bender.
Right, and he's now the Eagles tour manager, so he's still in the business. And so he warned me that Elton is troubled at the moment, and that it's likely that he might decide that he doesn't want to play anymore.
Oh.
So I stood in front of the stage, which is a pleasure to sit and stand in front of the stage and watch Elton John. And he kept looking at his watch.
Oh.
So I went over to the tour manager. I said, he keeps looking at his watch. He goes, yeah, that's a sign. So about 40 minutes into the show, he stands up and says, folks, I'll see you later. And he walks off the stage.
40 minutes.
40 minutes into a solo show, which is supposed to last over 2 hours. And we forgot to tell the guy who drove the limo that if Elton gets in the car, don't drive him. Just sit backstage.
And it won't start.
It's based on us. Yeah. So we had to pull up this giant door to get the limo out. So I realized what was going on. He walks off the stage, but walks right into the limo. Doesn't go into the dressing room. Walks right into the limousine. And I realized what's going on. And we had radios back then. This was the 70s. No cell phones or anything like that. So I radioed to the guy, make sure you close that door. Don't let the limo out.
It's like a giant garage door for the Coliseum.
Right.
Yeah.
And Elton never got back on stage.
Huh.
And thankfully, the audience, which is an Elton John audience, which is much more peaceful than a Judas Priest audience, accepted it. And Elton just never went back on stage. That was it.
Was that a bad mood? Was that what would you call that?
I think it was a bad move, him not going back on stage. I think I was concerned that Elton was going to get pissed at me because I didn't let him out.
Right.
And I thought
you
I was
had
out
a
of
caged
business.
Elton. Right.
Yeah. I said, okay, now it didn't work to get him back on stage. Will I ever work with Elton John again?
Is that back when he was like wearing the giant duck costumes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So that'd be funny getting yelled at by a giant duck backstage.
I would have told the limo driver, drive on stage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And hand him a microphone.
Yeah, met him off.
Can you imagine
stage.
If there was some sort of security like there is now at airports, and he had to walk through in a duck's uniform?
Yeah.
It was pretty weird. So that was, I had that happen with Elton John.
Wow.
Mike and Derby.
Good morning, guys.
Hey. Good morning.
Good morning, Jimmy. Quick question. I just want to know, when did you know that when you were a concert promoter, it was going to be your life and your livelihood?
When I dropped out of law school. I was in law school and doing concerts, and I went to law school in the year of 71 into 72, which is when I first started in Connecticut. I had been doing concerts in Ohio, where I went to college before that. And my first concert in Connecticut was supposed to be in November of 71 with the Allman Brothers Band. And about a week before the show, Dwayne was killed on his motorcycle. And I said to myself, thank God I'm in law school and I'll be a lawyer because this is a crazy business. And then on January 12, I think it was, of 1972, I did my first traffic show and my first show with at the New Haven Arena at the time. And it was just awesome. And I remember going home to my wife and saying, okay, I could either be a lawyer or I could be a concert promoter. And this was really at the beginning of the business. And
A concert what?
Yeah, my wife said, you should be a lawyer.
A lawyer, yeah. Go with the lawyer.
Yeah, it's a safe move. But the excitement of going to concerts is still in me right now at my age, and I felt it that night at the New Haven Arena traffic show, and I decided in January of 72 I'll try to do both, but by April of 72 I wasn't smart enough to do both. I couldn't run a business and also study for law school, and it was easy to make the choice then, so I just decided to drop out of law school.
Lucky for us you did.
Seriously.
Lucky for me.
No, lucky for Connecticut.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you brought so many shows to this state, so many great memories. My very first concert was 1977 Electric Light Orchestra at the New Haven Coliseum.
I remember that show.
Tickets were $6.50, $7.50, and $8.50.
Yes.
Wow. $8.50 for the top-tier ticket.
And they got paid $25,000 that night, which was a lot of money now. Now $25,000 is just how much we spent on food backstage.
Seriously, yeah, right.
For the artists. So it's quite a difference.
The Eggman.
Good morning, Jimmy and Jazz AJ.
Hey.
Wondering about if Ozzy gave you any problems during the Black and Blue concert.
No, actually, Ozzy never gave me problems. I love Ozzy. I love Sharon, his wife. We always had a great relationship. Ozzy would do anything I had ever asked him to do because we're friends. And Sharon made sure of that because Sharon was very close to my wife. And whenever I did an Ozzy show, I made sure I brought my wife to hang with Sharon so she wouldn't yell at me. Yeah, she's great at yelling at people. And I love her. So my wife was a good ruse to get her off to the side. But I had a couple instances with Ozzy. The night that he found out that Sharon was stricken with cancer, which was probably 20 years ago now, and thankfully she's overcome it, I was with Ozzy, actually, backstage at the Meadows, and I get told in advance that they're about to go in and tell Ozzy that Sharon has been diagnosed with cancer. So I said, oh, my God. I said, is there a way you can wait till after the show to tell him? Because let's just get the show on. It was during an Ozfest show. And they said, no. They have the sort of relationship they need to know right away, which I respected. So I went right in to Ozzy afterwards, and he looked at me, and he goes, is the audience out there? I go, yeah. I said, but we'll do whatever you want us to do. And Ozzy said, no, I play for the audience, and then I'll fly home the next day.
Wow.
And that was my first experience with Ozzy that really was very, very touching. And then about 2 years later, we had Ozfest. It was Black Sabbath at the time. And Black and Blue was Black Sabbath and Blue Oyster Cult, by the way, so people know what Black and Blue was. And I had a lot of Black and Blue shows, too. And so there's a riot going on, and I think it was Black Sabbath and Judas Priest were the two headliners of that Ozfest. And the audience on the lawn started to throw grass and sod and everything around, like they were footballs. And I don't know if anybody has ever been hit by a piece of sod.
Oh, yeah.
It will knock you out.
Yes, yeah.
It will truly knock you out.
Oh, yeah.
Whiplash.
And I had always built a relationship with the audience that I'm honest with them, and I'll tell them, and, I'm one of them. I've always been a great concert fan, so I get up on stage, and I say, I'm in charge of Ozfest for Live Nation, which I was in charge of Ozfest for Live Nation. I will never bring back Ozfest to Connecticut again if you're going to destroy my venue. Everybody puts everything down.
Right.
I calmed everything
chaos
down.
Chaos stops immediately.
It was
also put it back.
Threaten people. I learned it. Threaten people. I had kids at that point. So I knew what worked. We threatened them. And so I go back to Sharon. I go with, big chest out and feeling great about everything. Sharon, I just stopped a riot. She goes, how'd you do that? I said, I went on stage and I said, I'm never going to bring Ozfest back. And she looks at me and goes, two things. First of all, you're not in charge of Ozfest and where it plays. I'm in charge of Ozfest and where it plays. And number two, that's not your stage. That's my stage. You're not allowed on my stage unless I give you permission. I said, but Sharon, I stopped the riot.
Right. You're welcome.
I don't give a, I don't give a F about it. That's all.
Wow.
So, did you need a mop to mop up after yourself?
Yeah.
You got yelled at by Sharon?
I was laid out. Yeah. I was totally laid out. I was like knocked out by Mike Tyson at that moment.
Hey, Eggman, great question. Jimmy. Thank you. Jimmy Koplik, Live Nation in studio, taking your calls, 203-882-9757. Johnny Tree.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Hey, I just want to bring up probably a bad memory for you, the riots with Wu-Tang and Rage. What was the scene backstage with the bands? Did they even give a crap about the whole scene?
Well, they cared, but they thought it was kind of cool. And I really didn't deal with Wu-Tang because Wu-Tang had left the stage already and they were actually leaving the venue. It was really rage that I was dealing with at the time. Not only the rage in front of the audience, but the rage in backstage, the real rage guys.
A lot of rage.
And it was the worst damage I've ever had at a concert, no question about it. We had over close to $100,000 worth of damage. Whoa. That was 1997. Now it would be probably $500,000 with inflation worth of damage. And I'm running around back up on the lawn saying, stop breaking my building. Stop breaking my building. It's 1997. I was still a young guy. I was in my 30s, so I could run.
You could run.
Now I can run a 100-yard dash, fall four times before I get to the end of the dash, but I could make it still.
Yeah.
And the next day, the Hartford Courant had a race. It called it a race riot because Wu-Tang is black. But everybody on the lawn that was ripping the lawn apart and taking the fence down and setting the fence on fire were white guys.
Huh.
So I called up the Hartford Courant and I wrote a letter to the Hartford Courant saying that you mistakenly called this a race riot because there were black guys on stage before the riot and there were white guys coming on stage after the riot, but you assumed it was a race riot. It wasn't. It was a concert riot. And it was mostly white kids from West Hartford, tell you the truth, because we had a number of people arrested. And it was so much West Hartford, Avon, the west side of Hartford, the kids that were brought up in upper middle-class income families.
Right, insurance families.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was unbelievable. But it was really, really the biggest riot I've ever been involved in.
Wow.
And Rage Against the Machine, honestly, they thought it was sort of cool. But remember, we were all in our 30s then, so what we thought was cool in our 30s, when you get older, you look back and say, hey, you know, that's not so cool, you know?
Yeah.
So, but Tom Morello was great. Tom Morello was the one who calmed everybody down backstage about everything, so I give Tom a lot of credit. Lead guitarist.
As a fan, it was actually, it was a pretty interesting scene, that's for sure.
Interesting.
Hey, wait a second, were you tearing up my
Johnny,
lawn
were you part of the problem, Johnny?
I want to talk to you.
I would never incriminate myself, but I was there.
You're taking the fifth. Huh? Yeah. You're taking the fifth.
Right. All right. Thank you, Johnny.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
All right. Steve.
Hey.
Good morning.
Hey.
What's going on, guys?
What's happening? You're on with Jimmy Koplik.
Jimmy, you're a rock god.
Thank you.
Thanks for all the memories.
Appreciate it.
I went up to, it was a UConn spring concert. And I jumped up on stage, and I got pushed off, and I fell in between where the photographers are. So I jumped back up, and I was doing a little mosh thing, and I kicked the guitar player in the face.
Whoops. Vernon Reed.
Was Vernon Reed Living Color?
Yeah,
this was at the UConn Spring Concert up in Storrs.
So that wasn't one of your shows?
No, that wasn't one of my shows.
So you're okay with this?
Well,
we don't condone it.
What do you do?
Arrested for that?
Well, you kicked him in the face.
You got arrested for it?
Yeah.
Does that bother you that you got arrested for jumping on the stage and kicking somebody?
Well, I got arrested for assault.
Well, you kicked him.
Well,
in the
it sounds like you assaulted someone.
Yeah, right. Did that bother you? Do you think you shouldn't have been arrested for assault?
No, I shouldn't have.
Okay.
All right, so that's just regular concert behavior.
What is it, your foot slipped?
What is your job now?
I'm sorry, what?
What is your job now?
What do you do?
Oh, I'm a carpenter.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
still nailing things.
So you
back in the day, I used to have to leave work early to go to court all the time. Now I got to leave work early to go to doctor's appointment.
Right. Times have changed. I hurt my foot on some guy's face.
I know the feeling. You're so right, isn't it? I got my people that work for me that are in their 50s together about 2 weeks ago, and I said, you don't know what getting old is like. Enjoy yourself, because you wake up every morning with an ache somewhere on your body. There's an ache going on.
Enjoy yourself now.
Yeah, enjoy
Steve,
yourself now.
Luckily, you got all your kicking done early.
Yes.
Thanks, Steve.
Yes, I do.
All right. Sounds like he's wrestling with someone right now.
Seriously.
Is there a white elephant artist that hasn't played Mohegan Sun yet?
Paul McCartney. Tom Cantone and I have tried so hard. And as everybody knows, I talk about Tom a lot. He's a key element of our success at Mohegan Sun Arena. It's the arena that probably has more shows than any arena in the country. And that's thanks to Tom's hard work. And we have tried to get Paul McCartney in over and over again. And, you know, when Paul decides to play the States again, right now he's down in South America touring, we will make another effort to get Paul McCartney in. But that is the white elephant. Now, I did have Paul McCartney play Connecticut in the early 2000s. I think it was 2001. At the what was called the Hartford Civic Center, then now the Excel Center, which won't be called the Excel Center much longer.
Right.
It was one of my favorite shows that I ever promoted because it was just he's my Paul McCartney.
Paul McCartney normally plays for like 80,000 people.
Yeah.
Mohegan Sun is 10,000 people.
A little less, actually. It's if you sell all the way around, it's about 9,400 people.
What kind of a check would you have to write out to get Paul McCartney to play Mohegan Sun?
Multiple millions.
Whew.
Yes. Yes. Artists that play stadiums make somewhere in the $4 to $5 million range per night.
Wow.
And as I always say, they deserve it and they earned it because we are the perfect example of what real capitalism is about. Because if they can't sell out the stadium, they won't get paid that amount of money.
Right.
So if we put it on sale and the tickets sell out real fast, as happens with Paul McCartney all the time, he deserves what he gets paid.
Hmm. How much beer is sold at a stadium show, a sold out stadium show?
We will sell probably, if it's a 50,000 seat stadium, we'll sell between $500,000 and $750,000 worth of beer.
Wow.
That's awesome.
We help with that.
There you go.
We help with that.
Right. Add in some hot dogs and you got Paul McCartney covered.
Nice. So right in.
Andre in Waterbury. Or is it Andrea?
Hi.
Hello.
Andrea.
Hi. Good morning, Chaz, AJ, everybody, and Jimmy. Thank you for doing this. And Jimmy, I've seen Def Leppard twice in Connecticut. One was there in the round, and the other one, I was believe at the Groton Subbase.
Oh, yes, Groton Subbase. I remember that show. Yes.
Yeah, any good memories from them?
I have great memories from Def Leppard. My most favorite memory is when they opened up their tour at the XL Center with Journey. And it was a Monday night. And I've got a lot of great pictures hanging with the guys. They are the nicest people in the world, the band members. We hung out afterwards after the show. And they all wanted to meet me, and I wanted to meet them because I consider them one of the preeminent rock bands in history, to tell you the truth. They had this great way of creating great guitar licks and vocals along with melodies. And that is the secret to success in our lives. And I think you'll be seeing them come back in next year.
Nice.
Really?
Yes.
Good question, Andrea. Jimmy Coplick, Live Nation, is in studio now, and I'm so happy they're making a documentary about you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very excited, too.
I can't wait to watch it.
Yep.
Me, too.
Watkins Glen, the biggest audience for a paid concert. Your show.
My show with my partner, Shelley Finkel, and we did 600,000 people, three acts. I hate to call it a festival because it was one show, one stage, three artists.
Three amazing artists.
You're right. The Dead, the Allman Brothers Band, and the Band.
Unbelievable.
And we never looked at it as a festival. We only charged $10. If it was a festival, we would have done multi-days, multi-stages, and charged more than $10.
But it was successful.
It was very successful. And the reason people call it a festival is because it's 600,000 people.
Yeah.
Who goes to a concert that was 600,000 people? 600,000 people. I loved it. It was a great time for us. I was 23 years old. I had no idea what the hell I was doing. But we gave out free water because I was a hippie. Now I'm an old hippie, but I was a young hippie then. I didn't want people to have to pay for water. And now that seems to be the driving force of people's complaints that they have to pay for water, which I understand, at all-day festivals and with the summer heat.
What was the backstage like there?
Well, we all lived backstage for about a week up there. So we were all living in trailers. In order to set everything up, we worked really 24 hours a day. We caught, you know, what I call a little sleep here and there. Sometimes it'd be
naps.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were really naps.
Yeah.
I heard there was a trailer.
Power naps, yeah.
I heard there was a trailer just for drugs.
Yes, we had a drug trailer, and we had the peace sign over it because we couldn't put free drugs on it.
Right.
Because then there'd be a line. So we
looked for the peace sign trailer.
And we only told certain people about it. Of course, we told all the band members about it, so you could always walk into the drug trailer, and they were all hanging out, smoking pot, snorting coke, doing whatever they wanted to do. It was a great trailer to be in.
Right.
I didn't want the Coke to get all used up by the end of the concert. So my travel agent, I put in charge of distributing the Coke. So he said, how am I going to stop people? And I said, I don't know, but we got to make sure we have enough Coke for the whole
week. It's got to cover the whole thing. Yeah,
yeah, we got to. We can't all of a sudden fall asleep the day of the show.
Yeah,
because we're wiped out. And he grew his left pinky nail. I remember it so well. And if you went into the trailer to get your little dose of Coke, little hot, you know, shot.
Yeah.
He would just dip his fingernail into the pile of Coke on his desk. And he put it under your nose.
Yeah, keep blessed.
And that was it.
Yeah,
that was
a blast,
it.
Yeah.
You were being rationed.
Yeah.
Yes, you were being rationed. Now, you know, there were guys that would get back online again.
Right.
You know, come in a second time, we realized, wait, this isn't working out. So Roy, his name was Roy, had to start taking names down because we were running out of Coke. We almost ran out of Coke. We had to get in a helicopter.
Right.
I didn't know where to get Coke in Watkins Glen, so we had to take a helicopter back to Connecticut to find a dealer that would sell us Coke to bring back up to Watkins Glen.
It was a tool.
You were also moving money in the helicopter, right?
Yeah, yeah. That helicopter was put to very good use. We had paid the band $75,000, the Allman Brothers and the Dead each $110,000. And the tour manager for the Grateful Dead at the time was a guy named Sam Cutler. And Sam said, the Dead are not going on stage unless you give us a $25,000 bonus because you said the capacity was $150,000 and you've got 600,000 people out there.
We want more money.
We want more money. I said, but I didn't collect money from them. They broke down the fences and I didn't get any money. He goes, we want $25,000. I didn't have $25,000. This is 1973.
Yeah.
$25,000, again, it's like $250,000 now.
And you didn't have a card, a plastic card, then you could just say, here, run this.
Well, and I said, I'll write you a note, I owe you.
Yeah.
Well, we don't trust your IOUs.
Right, yeah.
So I had to get the guy who collected. There's no Ticketron or Ticketmaster business really back then. So I had to get my ticket guy that I hired, a guy named Brad, on a helicopter to come back to Connecticut and go through all, to get all the ticket outlets money. And he comes back about 12 hours later, and it was about 10 minutes before the Dead were supposed to get on stage, and he had it all in a paper bag, and it was fives and tens and singles and stuff like that. And he says, I got 25 grand, and he pours it out onto the table, piles of bills, and his dirty underwear were in there.
Oh, nice.
So I said, I'm not
That's
touching
a tip.
That. Yeah, I'm not touching that money. I'm not touching.
That was saved.
So the headline here for this segment would be the Grateful Dead got a $25,000 bonus and a pair of underwear.
Dirty underwear. Right.
Dirty underwear.
So I said to Sam, do me a favor, just don't tell the Allman Brothers because I agreed you both would get the same amount of money. 15 minutes later, Allman Brothers manager comes and says, I want $25,000.
Oh.
So, damn. That
okay,
Sam
get back in the helicopter.
You know how
damn
Seinfeld goes,
trailer.
Newman? I go, Cutler.
Cutler.
Can't believe Cutler did that. So I looked, I said, I don't have $25,000. I said, I'll write you a check for $25,000. I can't find another $25,000. They took my check, so that was fine. And I didn't stop it. I paid them. So that was great.
Turned out to be the greatest outdoor concert in the history of outdoor concerts.
600,000 people. We figured one out of 300 people in the United States were there because the population then was about 180 million people in the United States. So one out of every 300 people in the United States was at that concert.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really amazing. And I broke it down because I said, really, there were only people 15 to 30-year-olds were there. I said, how many 15 to 30-year-olds are in the United States? It probably was one out of every 10 or 15 people that are of that age group that were at that concert.
There are still cars and things out in the woods surrounding Watkins Glen from that concert.
That is true. It was such traffic jams. People left their cars, hitched rides with people that were moving, and the cars just stayed there.
Okay, one more. The time you were attacked by an artist backstage.
David Crosby.
Yes.
Springfield Symphony Hall. Remember it well. We had a concert in California, and it was called, it was before California Jam, and it was Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Joe Walsh, Beach Boys, Jesse Colin Young, and we put tickets on sale, and it was going to be about 2 weeks after the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young 1974 tour ended. And Neil was at that time married to Carrie Snodgrass, who was an English actress. So he went over to England during those two-week period and said, you know what, I don't want to come back for one concert. Why don't you just, the three of you guys, do the show? So So I get a call from the agent, a guy named John Podell. He says, well, now, instead of paying them $200,000, you only have to pay them $150,000. I said, why is that? Well, Neil's not coming back. It's now Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Oops.
I get, Neil's not 25% of that. Neil's like 75%, with all due respect to the other three guys. It's a different band with Neil Young in there. I said, I'm going to cancel the show, and I'm going to sue you guys unless Neil comes back. And I was 24 years old. I just was speaking garbage out of my mouth. I had no idea what I was doing. And the Neil wouldn't come back, so I canceled the show, and I sued Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young, $200,000, $50,000 each, which is what they were going to get paid to pay my expenses. And I said, we'll call it even. That's all. Neil paid me. David did not pay me. Graham paid me. And Stephen paid me. And David wouldn't pay. I said, I'll let it go. I don't care if David pays. I'll take $150,000. We'll settle at $150,000. So we're up in Springfield in 1981 or 82. So it was about 8 years later. And I stayed away from David because he wouldn't pay me, and I didn't know David. I knew Graham real well. I knew Stephen real well. And Graham makes this fatal mistake of saying, oh, you know who's over there? That's Jimmy Coplick. He's promoting the show. And David goes, that's the Jimmy Coplick that sued me? And Graham goes, yes, but you didn't pay him. We all paid him, but you didn't pay him. And David, being the cantankerous sort of guy that everybody knows he was, just came charging at me like a maniac. And thankfully, Graham Nash, who I thankfully have thanked 100 million times since, got between Graham, I mean, between David and myself, and pushed David away while I was running the other way.
Yeah.
Because I would have just cowered. I'm not going to throw a punch at David Crosby, that's for sure. So I was ready to cower in the corner and just take the beating he was going to give me. But Graham Nash protected me, which was great.
Close call.
Very close call.
Wow.
Well, Jimmy, thanks for coming in. Thanks for letting us be a part of this great document thing that you're doing here.
Well, and thank you, guys.
It's going to cover all the years.
It's going to cover all the years, and it's great seeing you guys.
Yeah.
And,
when's it coming out?
And I can't wait to see you at the Toy Drive on December 13th.
That's right. And I heard that Jimmy's going to be bringing tickets to something that has not been announced yet.
Ooh.
Coming to the amphitheater.
Nice.
And it's an oh, wow thing.
Cool.
So that will be at the Toy Drive at 9 o'clock when Jimmy takes the stage. So thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right.